That was a special theory of ontological relativity, the special theory being from this unus mundi, from this form realm, emerges this world of mind and matter as we know it. But a general theory, and I'll speed up a little bit, a general theory, a much more all-encompassing theory of ontological relativity, which is to say a relativity of the very nature of existence of the physical world vis-a-vis something else, rather than the physical world is what it's all about and everything else is derivative, right? John Wheeler, one of the most brilliant theoretical physicists of the latter half of the 20th century, aged 93, I believe, right now, still alive, hopefully well, but brilliant, just mind-boggling clarity, vision, insight, boldness of his thought. He's proposed a participatory universe. He's not the only one, but he's on the leading edge here. He's proposing the universe consists of a strange loop in which physics gives rise to observers and observers give rise to physics. In other words, once again, a symmetry. Not just physical universe giving rise to physics, but physicists looping with the physical universe that they are understanding and conceiving. That there is a mutual interdependence there. He said the conventional explanatory relationship is one of matter giving rise to information. So you've got a computer, right? And then it spews out information. And then we have information, and then we have observers looking at the computer and saying, oh, I can read that. There's matter, it's giving rise to information, and I'm the observer. Or there's the brain, chunky stuff, with information embedded in it, and then consciousness arising out of that. And he said, turn its head. Just turn that right around on top. Invert it. It is observers that make for the possibility of information. Without an informed, there is no information. No observer, no information. No information, no matter. Because matter is a construct based upon the information that we glean from our observations. Turn it right on its head. Quite stunning. I love it when they do that. He says the universe is fundamentally an information processing system from which the appearance of matter emerges at a derivative level of reality. More fundamental than that is information. More fundamental than that is the observer that makes information possible. And now he's a theoretician, a theoretical physicist, and one of the best we've had in the last 50 years. Anton Seilinger is arguably right on top of the right at the top of his profession as an experimentalist in the foundations of quantum mechanics. I have the great privilege of knowing him personally. We had a conversation about a year and a half ago in his lab in Vienna. He now has Schrödinger's position. And he made this comment in writing. He said, one may be tempted to assume that whenever we ask questions of nature, of the world there outside, there is reality existing independently of what can be said about it. Well, that's the assumption that underlines almost all of science. There's a real world out there. Let's figure out what's going on. Let's make observers. In other words, it's giving us information. We're not doing anything to it. Beware of a unilateral relationship. It ain't natural. One may be tempted to assume this, but we will now claim that such a position is void of meaning, void of any meaning. As Wolfgang Pauli said when he was at his most searing, he said, it's not even false. That's the toughest to give. What you're saying is not false. It's like, go away. What you said is so meaningless that it's not even worthy of answer. It's void of meaning. It's like going, blah, 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 blah. Yes or no? This implies, Anton Seilinger continues, this implies that the distinction between that is knowledge and reality is devoid of any meaning. In other words, he's crunching together epistemology and ontology. He said, just let's stop pretending that we know anything about the nature of reality independent of our measurements and our conceptual frameworks. Can we just stop? Because it's bogus. Or Werner Heisenberg 50 years ago said, let us not posit existence to that which is unknowable in principle. The universe as it exists, independently of all systems of measurement and all systems of conceptual formulation, is unknowable in principle. Therefore, why posit existence to it? That's hardcore quantum mechanics. Pretty cool. Because it suddenly suggests that man or human beings, let us say, is indeed the measure of all things that we measure. Now back to Buddhism, the middle way, this Madhyamaka view, according to this view, which is regarded by many, many people, especially throughout Tibet and Central Asia, classical India, as the pinnacle of Buddhist thought, declares that all objective and subjective phenomena exist only relative to the cognitive frame of reference from which they are apprehended. There are no colors without eyeballs. There are no visual cortexes without colors. This is known, it's a biological fact. If you have somebody who never sees for the first 50 years and just has a visual cortex, it's a bunch of out-of-work neurons back there. But to call it a visual cortex when you've never seen anything, why? It's not visual, you've never seen anything. And in fact, the auditory cortex will start pirating some of the neurons from the visual cortex because they're out of work, and you'll hear better. It's a type of neuroplasticity, it's quite interesting. But the visual cortex is dependent. For the visual cortex to be the visual cortex, there have to be colors and shapes. For there to be colors that we perceive, there has to be visual cortex. They are interdependent. No sounds, no ears. No ears, no sounds. And taste and touch, tactile sensations, they are mutually interdependent. There are not, and I think virtually all neuroscientists would agree with this, there are no colors out there. Colors do not pass through space. Molecules have no colors. Photons, I will say with great confidence, have no color. There are no yellow photons. Right. So mutual interdependence. Perceptual objects exist only relative to perceptual cognition. The Big Bang was not bright. It wasn't yellow. It didn't go boom, let alone the fact that it didn't take place in air, but there weren't any ears to hear it that we know of. So it was silent and it was invisible. Suddenly became very boring. A big bang that doesn't go bang, I mean, something's odd about that. But even more interesting, because that's kind of obvious, and I think most neuroscientists would go along with that, what is more interesting yet is that conceptual or theoretical objects exist only relative to the conceptual designation of them. They exist only relative to the conceptual framework in which they are conceived. Like an electromagnetic field. When was the last time you saw one? I believe they exist. Relative to the conceptual framework in which they're conceived. Based upon the measurements that we human beings invent. Independent of all systems of measurement, independent of all conceptual frameworks, the very notion electromagnetic field is not false, it's meaningless. Atoms, quarks, space, time, fields, particles, elementary particles, probability functions. I think physics is wonderful. Do they exist? I think so, yes, relative to the conceptual framework in which they are conceived. And the conceptual framework exists only relative to them. No physical world, no physics. No physics, no physical world. Because bear in mind, we define physical world, not the physical world. No phenomena define themselves. And that is true for physical phenomena, the objective phenomena, as also for the subjective. Neither one of these gets more heavily weighted. This is not leaning to say everything's just a projection of the mind. No, the mind exists in mutual interdependence upon the objects of the mind. No mind, no objects of mind. No objects of mind, no mind. Relativity, ontological relativity. Not only for matter, not only for mind, but for time and space itself, where it gets most fascinating. You can barely read it, I can read it quite clearly. Eugene Wigner, another Nobel laureate, brilliant, brilliant physicist. He claims here, I think this is an extraordinary principle, true for Buddhism, true for modern physics, and increasingly appearing to be true. He said, we do not know of any phenomenon in which one subject is influenced by another without exerting an influence thereupon. If A influences B, count on it, B influences A. For centuries, time and again in the history of physics, physicists did posit an A that influenced B without a reciprocal interaction. And the more they probed, the more they found that was not the case. One of the latest casualties in that was space-time. Matter influences space-time, space-time doesn't influence matter, whoops, until 1915. And, oh yes, it does. Right. What about time? The past influences the present, right? The flyers went out, we all showed up. The past influence, here we are. The past influences the present. Does the present influence the past? How could it? It's already happened. The present is influencing the future, right? Of course. Could the future influence the present? How could it? It hasn't happened yet. It looks like an asymmetry. The arrow of time, entropy, looks like it's one way. Eugene Wigner says, look out. Look out. And John Wheeler again, the breathtaking John Wheeler. It is wrong to think of that past as already existing in all detail. He's referring to that past as the last 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang, the past of the cosmos. He said it is wrong to think of that past as already existing in deal. It already absolutely happened, and we just need to map onto it. It's wrong, he says. The past is theory. The past has no existence except as it is recorded in the present. By deciding what questions our quantum registering equipment shall put in the present, we have an undeniable choice in what we have the right to say about the past. There are some very interesting experiments. We don't have time to go into them. But very briefly, you have a photon emitted from a distant galaxy, let's say 10 billion light years away. And John Wheeler proposed, do a double-slit experiment. Instead of in a lab, where this has been done many, many times, to try to determine the trajectory of the photon or the electron, and they found in the lab that the type of measurement that you make in the present actually determines the trajectory of the photon in the past. It's time delay. It's really, I can't go into it right now, but it's really interesting. And my mentor in physics, Arthur Zients, this was his baby, quantum optics. Really mysterious. But you can do that in the lab, that what took place in the past is determined by the type of measurement you do in the present. It's quite a lot of consensus there. Now, John Archibald Wheeler said, let's imagine here a big double-slit experiment where the photon is being emitted not 5 feet across the room, but 10 billion light years away. And now imagine you configure it differently so it can go on this trajectory or this trajectory, depending on your measurement system here and now. And lo and behold, you determine the trajectory of the photon over the last 10 billion years by the system of measurement you set up now. The way the past arises to us with respect to or relative to our cognitive frame of reference is determined by the type of questions we ask, the measurements we take, and the way we conceptually formulate the findings. By deciding what questions our quantum registering equipment shall put in the present, we have an undeniable choice in what we have the right to say about the past. Stephen Hawking, both of these people, taking the principles of quantum mechanics and applying them to the cosmos as a whole, is breathtaking, and I think they're on the right track. Stephen Hawking, very recently, with a fellow named Hartog, came out with this theory, very much in line with Wheeler. He said, every possible version of a single universe exists simultaneously in a state of quantum superposition, not actuality, possibility. When you choose to make a measurement, you select from this range of possibilities a subset of histories that share the specific features measured. The history of the universe as you conceive of it, very importantly, as you conceive of it, is derived from that subset of histories. In other words, you choose your past. Because the past is a construct based upon measurements made in the present. And what Stephen Hawking points out is we cannot get back into the past and look at it directly and then envision a universe coming from the past to the present. All that we can ever do is work from the present and extrapolate the past, but that's always based upon measurements made in the present, made sense of within a conceptual framework that is in the present. And in this way, we can formulate the past in multiple ways. Now, the assumption here, of course, is the past really took place and we're simply formulating it in different ways. Stephen Hawking says, not so fast. You're back into 19th century physics again. Grow up. Quantum mechanics, if we apply it to the cosmos as a whole, suggests that it is impossible to speak about any physical reality independent of the system of measurement. And there's no reason to posit a physical reality independent of system of measurement, as Anton Zeilinger said. Very spooky stuff. Can that possibly be put to the test of experience? A lot of physicists look with deep skepticism at this theory of Wheeler and of Hawking and so forth, and they said, whatever, how can you put that to the test? The Buddha said, we have. It's called vipassana, insight meditation, where you apply the principles of this middle way view which asserts the non-inherent nature, the non-intrinsic independent nature, not only of matter, not only of mind, but of space and time as well, the non-inherent nature of causality itself. It's not out there, inherent existent, just waiting to be passively discovered. Probe into this by way of contemplative inquiry, probing primarily into the very nature of consciousness and then its relationship with the world, and you will see for yourself this mutual interdependence, not only of mind and matter, but of space and time, all arising always relative to a cognitive frame of reference. That's in the daytime. In the nighttime, you can have a lot of fun practicing dream yoga, the dress rehearsal for waking reality, in which you, as you start to fathom the nature of the dream reality you're experiencing, you find that by shifting your frame of reference within the dream, you shift the dream. Okay, that's just the stuff dreams are made of. But then you take those principles and you apply them to daytime dream yoga. And you start exploring experientially to what extent is waking experience like a dream. It's a theory, it's a theme that's now coming out more and more prevalently in contemporary physics, not just in Buddhist contemplative practice. And what's taking place here in physics, as we draw pretty closely to an end here, is applying the principles of quantum mechanics to the entire cosmos rather than thinking that the entire cosmos is fundamentally classical and a quantum system is something artificially contrived in a special laboratory at great expense. This is John Wheeler. This was Bryce DeWitt. Came up with this applying Schrödinger's wave equation to the entire cosmos, and what they came out, when you take a quantum perspective on the entire universe, you get some very spooky things coming out, and this is one of them. Without introducing an observer, this is back to Wheeler, back to Hawking, back to Anton Seilinger, these people are taking quantum mechanics very seriously, without introducing an observer into the mesh of the natural world, just deleting that, as classical physics did, we have a dead universe, which does not evolve in time, implying the crucial role of the participant in the self-observing universe. It's called the problem of frozen time. That if you apply the Schrödinger wave equation to the entire cosmos, there is no time. Time falls out of the equation. You have an absolutely still, non-evolving, non-changing, timeless universe. You need an observer to do something. And what the observer says is now. As soon as you say now, with respect to the now that you fingered, with relative to that, you can say past, you can say then in the past, and you can say then in the future. But if there's no one to say now, there is no now or future or past. It's timeless. It comes right out of the mathematical equations. The universe becomes alive, that is time-dependent, evolving, not the universe at large, life itself, only when it is divided into two parts, a subjective observer and the rest of the universe. That's what Hawking was getting at in the preceding quote.